Good morning. It's 9.5 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine today here on the Ideas Network. And in this hour of the program, of course, it's the Week in Review, where we take a look at the news from the perspective of the right and the left, as we do each week at this time. And we have two guests to help us to do that. Craig Rosanne on the right is the chairman of the Douglas County Republican Party. Ron Merchard on the left is professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. And let me, I'm in a different studio than I'm usually in, so let's make sure that everybody is on. And gentlemen, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Hi, John.
And we'll lots of issues to talk about here. And, of course, the top issue internationally is what's going on in the Caucasus with the Georgians moving into South Ossetia to try to reincorporate that area back into their country, and the Russians intervening. And this has touched off a lot of discussion internationally with the Russians and the United States kind of going back and forth. At one point, the Russian foreign minister yesterday basically saying that the territorial integrity or the sovereignty basically of Georgia has been pretty much done away with. And, of course, some strong words from both the United States president, President Bush, and from various other spokespersons for the U.S. Let's start with you, Ron. On this issue, there's a lot of discussion about renewing the old Cold War, and that seems to be what a lot of the rhetoric is about.
Yeah, and I think that probably a lot of it traces back to actually the position of Poland and the Polish relationship to the EU and NATO, and our striking a defensive posture with American missiles in Poland. That's got the Russians angry as hell, and that, I think, really led to an effort to demonstrate to former Soviet countries that they're under influence of Russia today.
Well, Poland had sort of rejected missiles in their territory until Russia started moving on Georgia. I think President Bush's attitude on how to respond to the Russians in Georgia has just been brilliant. He knows he can't put combat troops on the ground.
God knows.
But he's put in military aid, in military equipment, with the understanding by the Russians, I'm sure, that if there's so much a scratch on that equipment, we're still the country with the best toys. And we've started to build a land bridge to the Ukraine. We have Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and I think Romania are now parts of NATO. And so we can resupply Ukraine if they ever become a member of NATO. And that's what's probably really upsetting the Russians, is that we're creating a buffer states just like they did during the old Cold War. Poland is now considering putting missiles in, provided that we help to update their military, which is a double nightmare for the Russians. I think it's just been an absolutely brilliant response. It's aggressive and moderated at the same time.
There's also questions of petroleum supply and the fact that there are now three, or is it four, pipelines that run from the Caspian Sea in the direction of the West. And the Soviet Union enjoys being able to cut off supplies of natural gas and petroleum to Europe, which is dependent on Russian energy supply. So there are lots of complications here.
That's true. That's probably why the Western European response has been so weak, except Sarkozy in France, who's been pretty much leading the charge. The oil flowing from Azerbaijan to Turkey is absolutely essential to the West, and most of Europe gets their oil from Russia. And so, ironically, this is a war for oil.
And natural gas as well. And that's interesting that President Sarkozy has been such a big player in this. France and Germany were two of the countries that most opposed the plans to put Georgia and the Ukraine into NATO. We've got a caller who wants to join us, and let's go ahead and take that call. This is Stephen from Madison. Stephen, good morning.
The U.S. doesn't look itself in the mirror and see a form of Nazi empire building. why did the U.S. military trainers pull out of Georgia about a week before the Georgian attack on Ossetia? Why has the Polish decision to put in missiles just been announced? Is it all coincidence, or is this part of a master plan by the U.S. using NATO to encircle Russia and China, by the way, in its quest for world domination? What do you think of that, boys?
Kind of a liberal, paranoid question from Madison. How unusual.
It's a perspective. but the interesting thing about it is that without raising the issue of the Nazi Empire and all the rest of it, it is clear that the perspective from Washington is different than the perspective from Moscow. And the especially with Putin in charge in Russia, the revival of the old Soviet empire is far from impossible so far as he's concerned.
I was a little confused. Who was he calling Nazis, Americans or the Russians?
I think his reference was to American policy. I got that impression.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, if we can go even farther back. We talked about the Soviet Empire, but if you look back even farther, in imperial times, Russia had a huge interest in what was going on in places like, oh, I don't know, Serbia, mm-hmm. For example. I mean, this isn't anything new. The Russians have always looked to have a sphere of influence on the countries surrounding their borders, and it's like, how do you fault them for wanting that kind of thing?
Russian imperial policy was built on a model of Pan-Slavism, and they argued that somehow the other Slavic states were poor cousins and had to take Russian leadership, Russian imperial leadership, and that was a Russian perspective that in some ways probably gets revived.
I think the biggest threat to the Russians is that they're starting to be surrounded by free, prosperous, democratic states. And they find this a threat. They're trying to revive their old empire. And I think empire building is over. It's unlikely that Georgia is going to become a part of NATO because they can't be easily resupplied. But once again, Ukraine can be. I think the policy we've been following in Georgia is aggressive yet moderated and has been rather brilliant.
Let me give the phone numbers and let people join the discussion here. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. Good just about anywhere you can hear the program, although I'm told that number is not good in Australia. So you'll have to send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. And if you're calling from Madison, you can use 263-1890. We are. This is the Week in Review. We've got perspectives on the news from the right and the left, and a lot of news left to cover. You know, usually, if this wasn't a presidential year, this would be the dog days of summer, and people would be on vacation. There wouldn't be as much news to cover as there is. We will get to the presidential race, but I'm kind of holding that for later. Don't want to broach that subject too soon, and then have people who aren't interested in anything else tune away. This is a radio programming issue. I tell you what, we'll take a. I believe we can take a break, and when we come back, we'll switch to another topic and take some calls. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 19 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday morning. I will be sleeping in. Here's what's coming up a little bit later today on the Ideas Network. After 11 on Garden Talk, Jim Packard's guest is Great Lakes gardener Melinda Myers, host of the popular PBS TV show, and can be reached at www.melindamyers.com. Anyway, that's coming up on Garden Talk after 11. This hour, it's the Week in Review. We've got guests from two different political perspectives. Craig Rosanne on the right, who is the chairman of the Douglas County Republican Party. Ron Marchard is on the left, and he is professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Well, we've got callers who still want to talk about Georgia, so let's take those calls and then move on to another topic. We'll go first to Larry in Madison. Larry, good morning.
It seems to me that both Georgia and Russia are to be blamed in this situation. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, South Ossetia has been, in practice, an independent country, not part of Georgia. And South Ossetia's population is largely Russian, many of its people want to be part of Russia. Now, it is true that Georgia is an ally of the United States. However, Georgia invaded South Ossetia. The United States should condemn Georgia's invasion. It was a bloody, unprovoked invasion. Georgia killed 1,000 to 2,000 South Ossetians. Now, Russia may have overreacted, probably did. So it seems to me that the United States, to be objective about it, should be questioning both Russia and Georgia in this situation. Thank you.
Well, he is correct to a degree that there's been contention between Russia and Georgia over South Ossetia. Basically, this occurred because when the Soviet Union dissolved, South Ossetia voted to stay with the Russian Federation, but Georgia had always claimed the area. This is an area with 50 different ethnic groups and is incredibly complex, and there was fighting between Georgia and South Ossetia, but I don't think we can call the positions equal. In this period of time, Russia has moved away from being a democratic nation. At best, they're semi-free. And Georgia, with their Rose Revolution, reasserted the rule of democratic policies and democratic attitude. Georgia isn't really an ally of the United States because they're not a member of NATO, but they are pro-Western, and it is in our interest to support Georgia. And I think we've done it in a remarkably good way. We're being aggressive. We're calling Russia on their human rights abuses and their invasion. And we're supplying aid, humanitarian aid, flown in by U.S. military aircraft to help alleviate the situation. And it's kind of Russia knows how this game is played, and it's being played brilliantly.
There's another thing that one might comment on. A lot of the perspective from the State Department in Washington, D.C., sees the issues around the Caspian Sea as being related to our issues, if you want, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I think that that perhaps, plus some difficulties between the Russians and the U.S. government, have put blinders on both sides. The Russians see this as they're right in reasserting, I'll go back to the common pan-Slavism, and so far as the United States is concerned, it's our policy that should be dominant, and there's no answer. Sooner or later, we're going to have to work this out. Something besides sending Condoleezza Rice, her person and her body to the capital of the country. That was interesting, but I don't know if that was clever. I'm not sure.
All the Russians understand the symbolism. Georgia is a profoundly pro-American country. When George Bush visited, there were crowds of over 300,000, and they're enthusiastically pro-American, and they're pro-democracy. The Rose Revolution proved that. And I think we just have to support them in any way we can, which includes humanitarian aid flown in by military aircraft, perhaps downgrading the Russian Federation from G8 to not a member of the G8 at all. Let's make it the G7. You know, Russia had put in a boycott on Georgian goods. They basically were trying to strangle the Georgian economy. I find it ironic that as early as February, the foreign minister of Russia, Putin and Shashkevili met in order to improve relationships and talk about economic matters, and that fell apart pretty quickly.
Let's take another call. This time it'll be Dave in Wanakee. Dave, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I think it's interesting the contrast between the two presidential candidates in their reaction to the conflict. Barack Obama said that the UN Security Council should meet to pressure the two sides to prevent an escalation and promote a peaceful resolution. John McCain said he was sending Senators Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman to Georgia to discuss it with the Georgian president, and he would get a report back from them. Wasn't that incredibly presumptuous of John McCain to think that he could determine American foreign policy?
Well, it is a presidential election year. And, you know, having this dealt with by the UN Security Council is not going to be effective. Russia is on the UN Security Council, and they're just simply going to veto any measure that's not in their interest. Most definitely, John McCain has the clearest credentials on foreign affairs of any of the candidates, that ran throughout the election, from, you know, Mitt Romney to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. You know, I think Barack Obama could improve his credentials tremendously if he just picked John McCain as his vice president.
Oh, well. I'm not going to follow through on that one.
Not likely to happen, I think.
Okay. Well, let's move to another topic then. A little bit lighter news. The newly released files detail the early United States spy network. Before Julia Child became known to the world as a leading chef, she admitted to being impulsive when she applied for a job as a spy. The details about Child's background and nearly 24,000 other OSS employees are revealed in a newly released document by the National Archives, withheld from public view as classified records for decades by the CIA. So before she was a chef, well, this was fairly well known for the last 6 or 8 years, I believe. It was 2002 this was made public, but now the full archives, we can see a whole list of people who worked for the old OSSS, and presumably they're all dead, so no one's safety is compromised.
I think we really need to project the world as it was in those years of the early 1940s, even before the U.S. was engaged in the war. We were preparing ourselves for war, and while some people said, oh my God, the draft, not me, there were others who cheerfully volunteered and put themselves forward and saying, I'm going to do my duty as a loyal American citizen. I think that, not to be pretentious or presumptuous, but I think my father at age 37, having an operation so that he could volunteer for the Navy in 1942, is a kind of parallel. It was, to all of his brothers-in-law, a foolish thing to do. My dad's point of view, it was a necessary thing to do. I think that if you were a woman in those years, how did you have any impact? If there were new agencies developing and she became aware of it, I'm not surprised that Julia Child, being the person that she was, decided that was a way to serve. We had women on this campus as faculty who had served in the Navy during World War II and as officers in the U.S. Navy Reserve. We have to remember that patriotism was real and had impact in those years, and was a much cleaner possibility than we see it today with the development of anti-war attitudes.
Well, patriotism is still real today, but well, I know your sentiments on that. My father served in the Army. He was aboard Liberty ships transporting trucks, and my mother was a welder building those Liberty ships in New Richland, California. The country united like it never had before. Maybe that's why whenever we have a big problem, politicians start talking about declaring war on it to try to get, you know, war on poverty, well, war on drugs, war on education, though I don't know who the enemy is there. I feel like a target sometimes.
And about war on education. But no, I think seriously, it is not as shocking to me, as in part because I can't remember when I first found out about this. She was never exactly coy about it. There were people who knew her who were quite aware of her OSS service. But, of course, we have to translate what OSS means today because that's fallen out of our understanding. Not CIA, but Office of Strategic Services. And while Bill Donovan was the man in charge.
Well, every government needs an intelligence gathering arm. You can't, right. This has been true for thousands of years, and you always, the more you know, the better you are at being able to make policy. And if you get bad information, you make bad policy.
Well, let's be very specific about this. The U.S. had a very vigorous FBI in those years, and nothing in the way of international intelligence. So it had to be invented from the ground up. And that's why the OSS came to be, and suddenly we had to engender all sorts of people to engage in the act and to call Julia Child a spy. I think misunderstand what she was doing.
Matahari with spices.
not likely.
You had mentioned, Ron, that you were influenced by Julia Child when you were touring Europe.
Well, you know, the interest in food is a family phenomenon. My size perhaps reflects that.
I've got a body built for radio, too.
My father cooked the way his mother cooked. And his mother was a lady, as my father was, born and become a person in Belgium and then came to the United States. So we tended at home to eat, you know, stewed rabbit with red cabbage and things of that character. And so interest in food has always been there. And I undertook to start to do part of the family cooking when I was in high school. So food and cooking was always interesting. And then, of course, to travel there when I was just out of school brought me into the whole realm of different cuisines and different kinds of food. So,
well, I have five sisters, and my experience with learning new foods was rather unusual as they learned to cook.
Whatever they were experimenting with, right?
Yeah. It's amazing how many ways you can make meatloaf.
Yes.
So are you planning on publishing a conservative cookbook anytime soon?
Meat and potatoes.
I think that would probably be it. And I can expect a red, white, and blue cover, I'm sure. Let's take quickly a call from Dan in White Lake. We'll go back to a foreign policy question for just a moment. Dan, good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Well, on the food topic, I have to say my surname is the third most common Irish surname in the world, but I married my sister so that her married name became Sandoval, and the whole family discovered there's more to a seven-course meal than a six-pack of beer and a boiled potato. I think it's ludicrous to consider John McCain experienced in foreign policy. That's just simply not true. You don't get much experience tied to the ceiling in a Vietnamese prison, no matter how long you spend there. He couldn't even
keep his own
plane in
the air. But you do on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee.
So he's incompetent as a soldier, sailor, airman. My greatest fear is Barack Obama will be the reincarnation of Jimmy Carter.
Oh, I agree with you there.
God help us.
Jimmy Carter only really had two major difficulties when he was president, and that was foreign and domestic policy.
You know, honestly, I would have a hard time arguing with that, although our host has placed me on the left. I have to tell you that in 1980, I announced the formation of a committee to find a presidential candidate for the Democrats other than Jimmy Carter, the incumbent. And being a maverick is a game that I've played more than once. And so I found myself, surprisingly enough, chairperson of the Kennedy Committee in Douglas County, which was fascinating, frankly, I got to tell you, because all my backers and supporters seemed to be people from the Finnish American community. Lots that was an interesting game.
Lots of radicals there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We're going to move on. Let me give the phone numbers again in case people want to join us. 800-642-1234, 263-1890. It's the Week in Review on Wisconsin Public Radio. The number in Madison to call is 263-1890. And did I give the 800 number wrong? It's 800-642-1234. I've got too many pieces of paper in front of me. There's no question about that. We're taking calls and emails at talk@wpr.org. Let's move on. The Olympics is, of course, the story that tends to suck the oxygen out of the room unless one country invades another. But the Olympics in Beijing was controversial before they started. Lots of attention being paid to China and its internal policies and so forth. Since the Olympics has been on, the focus has been more on the athletes and less on the politics, at least in terms of the news coverage. And the news coverage coming out of China has generally had a positive tone to it. So what about the Olympics? Let's talk about the Olympics in general. How important are they in terms of international politics? And countries being able to generate a positive vibe about themselves by hosting. And Ron, why don't you go first on this one?
Well, as I'm not an athletics expert, but I will say this. The Olympics have always fascinated me. I grew up with the growth of television coverage and involved myself in watching Olympics, even though I was not an athlete. It was fascinating to watch people of such high quality. And over time, it's been interesting to see the Olympics become less U.S. and Europe dominated and more international. I think that when we watch the Parade of Nations, as I certainly did a few days ago, and see nations that have a few thousand people on an island archipelago in the Pacific proudly march in with their national banner, followed by five athletes, you become aware of what the Olympics have come to represent. And especially, let's say, with the changes and the shifts in significance of the UN, it's a way in which countries all over the world express themselves. And I think that's interesting and that's impressive. It isn't very likely that that Tonga is going to walk off with six gold medals, but it is, I think, significant that they participate. And by the way, it's you would have to be deliberately obtuse not to recognize that we were anxious about whether there was going to be a Tibetan bloodbath, and instead it's the Uyghurs from another province who have been slaughtering Chinese policemen. So China's problems are very real. They're not going to go away in a hurry, and it's not a thing that we should or could become involved in.
Well, hopefully the Olympics will be a forum to promote international peace and cooperation. It's kind of ironic that Russia invaded Georgia during that, and that Georgia defeated Russia in girls' beach volleyball.
I tell you something. I don't think it was an accident that the president was on vacation in Beijing when this happened.
And Barack Obama in vacation in Hawaii.
Right, so, right. Policy, international policy is fascinating, but I'll be darned if it's easy to understand.
That's true. It's nice to see that the United States is ahead in the overall medal count. Obviously, the Olympics is also a forum for patriotism. I think a lot of people have become aware of some of the problems in China, especially the pollution problems. Beijing is a pollution nightmare, and it's ironic that so few people in such a populous country are attending the Olympics. I think they were warned that if you show up to the Olympics, you're suspect, and Chinese citizens aren't showing up in very large numbers.
Well, there's enthusiasm, but the tickets are controlled, I think.
Yeah,
who
probably
gets them and the like. But, you know, it's obviously a source of Chinese national pride to see their athletes do well. But there's no question that availability of water and other supplies is significant. The Chinese don't have the petroleum supply that they would like to have, and so they are customers going to the Mideast seeking petroleum, and by that very fact, helping to drive up the cost of gasoline in the United States.
Oh, certainly. There's a world demand for oil.
That's right.
The price isn't decided just locally.
And it's not a conspiracy.
No, it's
not. It's just reality, you know.
Yes, it is.
Population of the world increases, and it's increasing technology has an impact. And I don't think we can afford to be too snobbish about international oil belongs to us. That isn't true.
No, we should go after our own and start drilling offshore.
Another question, different topic.
The Olympics, Michael Phelps, of course, the big American story, and how many gold medals will he get? The sidebar to that is that Michael Phelps has become the bookie's nightmare. So I don't
worry about bookies a whole lot.
Well, I don't wager. I never even used to play marbles for keeps, so... I don't wager. I just thought that was an interesting story, that there's a lot of people who will bet on anything, you know, which elevator will stop first or something in an office building. But Michael Phelps has now become officially a bookie's nightmare.
I want you to know something. I'm going to make a confession here. During World War II, when I was just a little kid, we lived in a very strange, obscure little apartment hotel. My mother and I, while my dad was in the South Pacific. And I became a runner for the local bookie, who was the pharmacist on the corner drugstore. That's with Chicago, you understand. And all the newsstands certainly were bookies also. And so I ran bets through the 4 years of the war, and also dealt in
cigarettes and liquor and things of that sort for the ladies that lived in that apartment building. It's a very strange piece of my personal history.
Well, I'm not much of a bettor either. I once went to a casino down in Hibbing and found it very unsatisfying because if I would just made a contribution to the local tribe, at least it would have been tax deductible.
Right.
And, you know, Phelps is doing so well that the bookies are only paying out 5-2 on any bets made on him, and it seems almost a certainty, people think, that he's going to win 8 gold medals and wins beat Spitz's record. There was kind of a spoof on talk radio yesterday that I found hilarious. You know, Phelps is eating 12,000 calories per day. And that's 6 times as what is needed in order to sustain the average human. The global effect, the global warming from his lifestyle just must be devastating the planet.
Well, you has to get the energy from someplace, obviously.
All to win gold medals and put little countries down.
Yeah, the problem is some of us eat 10,000 calories a day and don't get any exercise. That probably is contributing a great deal more to global warming. Let's move to the presidential race. And before we talk about the advertising, this was mentioned earlier. I don't know if it was a caller facetiously said that Barack Obama should ask John McCain to be his vice president. But let's talk about that. One of the things that both candidates have yet to do, and this isn't in your packet, I'm going off script here, but I know you can both talk about this. One of the things that both candidates have yet to do is to pick a vice president. And so the question I'm going to toss out is, what's the strategy here, and how long can they afford to wait before they pick a running mate? So, Craig, why don't you go first on this one?
They can wait until the last day of the convention to pick a candidate, right. Try to maintain as much tension as possible. The article that we received is that McCain says he'd run with a Republican who supports abortion rights. And the articles that go on mention how McCain has been doing better than Obama in solidifying the conservative base of the Republican Party, where Barack Obama has not done quite as well pulling over previous Clinton supporters. You know, I think if he's considering Governor Ridge of Pennsylvania in order to try to win Pennsylvania, which seems to be a toss-up state, according to some analysts, he might be making a serious mistake. We're less regional in nature than we previously were, and McCain has a solid record on being pro-life. If he selects a pro-abortion vice president, he's going to come into serious conflict with the base of the Republican Party, in my opinion. The two big issues in this election, I think, are foreign affairs and who's got the most expertise, and the economy. And the candidate that had the most expertise on the economy was Mitt Romney, and that's who I would like to see him pick as his vice presidential candidate, or John Huckabee.
Ron?
Mike Huckabee.
I can't resist this, Craig. As long as McCain gets his geography straight, he might be a very effective foreign policy president. And cultural issues we could get into too, but let's not. Right now, the question of who your vice presidential candidate is relatively modest. We're not likely to swing whole states and states with remarkably small a number of electoral college votes by picking the governor of New Mexico or what have you. Quite frankly, there's a lot of talk about how states go and who has a lead. I got to tell you something. If you look at the data that we were presented on the Pew Trust, we have to immediately assume that not one person from Wisconsin has been interviewed. And that's because it says registered voters. And we don't register party affiliation in this state.
True.
I'll add to it, the models they're building on are the 2000 and 2004 elections, which are increasingly irrelevant. And in fact, with more and more people joining the game and involving themselves in the primary elections at a level we've never seen before, it seems to me that the people who spend their time making telephone calls to landline households are touching on a part of the population and not the whole of the population, and we'll have that poll in November.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and the rest of the hour will be about the presidential campaign. Lots to talk about there, and we'll get into those issues in just a moment. We have some callers who are waiting to join us, and you could be among them at 800-642-1234 and 263-1890, or send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9 o'clock this morning, Veronica Rickert will have the show about the OED turning 80. Of course, the OED is the Oxford English Dictionary. And her guest after 9 talks about his fascination with this document, and he spent a year reading every word of it. Well, that in itself ought to be fascinating to hear about. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's the Week in Review, where we take a look at the week's news from a pair of political perspectives. We have Craig Rosanne, chairman of the Douglas County Republican Party, taking the right, and Ron Merchart, professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin-Superior, taking the perspective of the left. And, gentlemen, the presidential race is on. It's hotly contested. The polls are getting narrower. Both candidates are running a lot of advertising. One of the things we're going to talk about in the next few minutes is political advertising. And so to set that up, I want to play a couple of different spots, one from McCain and one from Obama. These ran during Olympic coverage, so this will be the audio of what went on. And so here is this first one is a McCain spot.
Washington's broken. John McCain knows it. We're worse off than we were 4 years ago. Only McCain has taken on big tobacco, drug companies, fought corruption in both parties. He'll reform Wall Street, battle big oil, make America prosper again. He's the original Maverick. One is ready to lead. McCain.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
Okay, there's the McCain spot. Let's talk about that for just a minute. Craig, it seems counterintuitive that John McCain would be telling us that we're worse off than we were 4 years ago when there's been a Republican in the White House.
Yeah, that does seem kind of ironic. And as far as the ad claiming that he's an outsider, I don't think Obama or McCain, both senators, can claim to be outsiders. I do agree that he's the original Maverick. He has bucked the leadership of the Republican Party repeatedly on everything from immigration to campaign finance reform. He's by far the most moderate candidate, which is probably why he's had a little bit of difficulty with his base. Barack Obama is also a Washington insider, claiming to not be one. And his record is becoming more clear as probably the most liberal senator in Washington. NARAL gave him a very high rating, 85%, and the American Conservative Union gave him an 8% rating. But everybody this year wants to run as a Washington outsider, and yet they're both senators. And I think the last time somebody went from the United States Senate to the presidency was John F. Kennedy, and before that it was Harding.
Yeah.
I predict they both picked governors so you can have people with executive experience.
Ron, go ahead.
Well, other than the fact that I was a little bit astonished by the McCain message, it doesn't convince me because, quite frankly, we're looking at a person who has key figures on his staff who are drawn from the lobbyist community in Washington, D.C., and that's not new. Ironically enough, that he is half of McCain-Feingold, and at the same time is very close to an awful lot of people who helped organize and run his campaign who are lobbyists. And if there is a problem in Washington, it is the lobbying community. That's my conviction, and apparently it's also Obama's conviction.
It'll be interesting to see if Obama wins, and I don't think he's going to. Who he picks for his cabinet. You know, there's been talk that Governor Doyle might be his attorney general, and I don't see how Governor Doyle represents change or something different. He's old school, and he's got an awful lot of people in his campaign that are Washington insiders and old school politicians, and I don't see any change happening there at all from either. But McCain represents, in my opinion, my values, and is more moderate in nature. So it's kind of a...
You think Barack Obama is more liberal than, say, Senator Feingold?
Yes.
Really?
That's interesting. Feingold decided not to run this time around, and I don't think anybody was, except for the Feingold supporters, was too distressed by that. But he certainly is consistent, and one of the most consistent figures in Washington, and makes quite unpopular votes from time to time, reflecting his perspective. But that's Feingold. I mean, he's not who we're talking about this time around.
He did have an exploratory committee, and I think he realized the support wasn't there.
Yeah, let's take a quick phone call, and then I want to play an Obama ad, because that'll be interesting, too. Mike in La Crosse is on next. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a couple comments, I guess. First of all, on McCain and Obama, who will be their choices of running mates is probably the most important issue to me, based on my perceived lack of that both of them lack foreign policy experience, much like one of your guests said earlier. You know, what kind of experience did McCain get as a prisoner of war? Now, myself, I'm a retired U.S. Army military intelligence officer, retired lieutenant colonel. Career officers go through a great deal of required education, Command General Staff College, War College for senior officers. I don't think McCain attended any of those schools when he was a prisoner of war. I respect his record, but I question his grasp of foreign policy and his education to grasp foreign policy. And the same comments apply to Barack Obama. Barack Obama, if he would choose somebody of the caliber of General Wesley Clark or Senator James Webb as a running mate, I would probably vote for him without question. Now, second thing, you're talking about Georgia, their breakaway provinces. What is the Russian ethnic population of those provinces, and how was that population built up? Was it because of settlement during the time of the Soviet Union, specifically for that purpose, to put a Russian population in those border provinces, much like China has done in Tibet and Mongolia? And those are my comments.
All right, thanks for that. A couple of different points to talk about there. Let's stick to the presidential one. Here's a caller doesn't really believe in the foreign policy experience of either candidate. Ron, you want to go first?
You know, we talk about the vice president choice by by the candidates. I put it to you, one of the most sensitive decisions to be made by whoever is president come January is the Secretary of State. State Department is always remade by each new president, and the key figure is often the choice of Secretary of State. To me, is the thing we'll not know a damn thing about until sometime in December or January, and that will be a good indicator of the thrust and direction of the next administration. I just can't get passionate about who the vice president is, except if that vice president is Dick Cheney.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the caller's question and perspective. I disagree, however, that John McCain doesn't have foreign policy experience. He's been on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I believe, for decades, and has a great deal of experience as far as picking Secretary of State. I think you're correct. Frequently, we see, though, the State Department and the Secretary of State seem to be operating at contrary goals. It's almost as if the State Department runs on its own. As far as vice presidential pick, it's primarily, I think, in order to shore up the candidate's weaknesses. And I think John McCain's strength is foreign affairs. And I would really like to see Mitt Romney, because he has the strongest credentials on economics. But, you know, Mike Huckabee is an excellent candidate, too.
Okay, well, I want to play this is an ad that Obama is running in the Olympics, and here is what that sounds like.
It begins with a plan to build, a plan to put hardworking Americans first. Barack Obama, he'll put the middle class ahead of corporate interests to grow the economy, end tax breaks for companies that ship jobs overseas, help businesses that create jobs here, invest in education, cut taxes for working families, and make energy independence an urgent national priority.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Craig?
Well, that's an interesting bucket list, but I haven't heard a plan. I think that's part of the difficulty. Hope isn't a strategy and change isn't a plan. How does he intend to make us energy independent when you're not going to consider drilling offshore? We have three times the oil reserve of Saudi Arabia. 80% of the American public is in favor of drilling offshore, including a majority of Floridians. He just seemed to overall have a "you should be afraid that somebody's been taking something from you" attitude. I don't see the building together in that ad. It's the time old, this is who to blame, and that's how you win elections. Tell people what they should be afraid of, who it is to blame, and that's how you win. And it's a clever ad, but it's not a plan for anything.
Setting goals is interesting, but I think we all know that among the most important ballots to be cast in this next election will be the election of the United States Senate. If you are going to accomplish anything as president, look at the first term of first 2 years of Bill Clinton's administration, then you have to have a legislature that will support your initiatives. And quite frankly, I'm more fascinated by the number of U.S. senatorial elections that are in play in this election than I am the rhetoric of candidates for president. They might rally people state by state, but who is your legislature and what leadership would you find there? In achieving presidential policy is extremely important. So this is a multifaceted election, not just the presidency, although that is the symbolic key to a presidential election.
And we're just about out of time, so I don't want to introduce a new topic here because we only have a few seconds left. So I think what I'm going to do is say thank you to both of you for coming in this morning and for participating in our program. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Sure, John.
Craig Rosen is the chair of the Douglas County Republican Party, and Ron Merchart is the professor emeritus of history at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. They join me in the studios here in our Superior Bureau for Week in Review this morning, and appreciate them coming in. We have lots more programming coming up for you today on the Ideas Network, so stick around and be part of it. This program was produced by Cynthia Schuster and Rob Ferret, and I appreciate both of them very much. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine today. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Veronica Rickard is in next after the news after 9 o'clock.